6 and go down through about verse 10. There's one particular phrase I want to focus our attention on. Verse 6, Joshua chapter 2. When Joshua had dismissed the people, the sons of Israel went each to his own inheritance to possess the land. The people served the Lord all the days of Joshua and all the days of the elders who survived Joshua, who had seen all the great work of the Lord which he had done for Israel. Then Joshua, the son of Nun, the servant of the Lord, died at the age of 110. And they buried him in the territory of his inheritance in Timnath-Heres, in the hill country of Ephraim, north of Mount Gaash. Now, verse 10. All that generation also were gathered to their fathers, and there arose another generation after them who did not know the Lord, nor yet the work which he had done for Israel.
Which chapter, which book are you reading?
Judges. Did I say Joshua? I may have said, I'm sorry. Thank you, Owen. I appreciate that. Yes, this is Judges chapter 2 and verses 6 through 10. All right. Now, verse 10 contains the phrase that I want us to focus our attention on. There arose another generation after them who did not know the Lord. So Israel served the Lord all the days of Joshua and all the days of the elders who survived him. But then, after that generation had gone, there arose a generation, another generation, that did not know the Lord. Now, what does that phrase mean? A generation who did not know the Lord. Well, for one thing, he's not talking about a bunch of atheists. When he said another generation arose that did not know the Lord, he's not saying that there arose a group in Israel, they were just atheists, they didn't believe in God. No, they knew about God. They knew about God. They'd been raised to believe in God. They knew who the God of Israel was. But when it says that they did not know the Lord, it means that they didn't have the same appreciation for the Lord that the previous generation had. Didn't have the respect, didn't have the regard for it. Remember when Joseph was in the high position in Egypt and there arose another Pharaoh who did not know Joseph? Oh, Pharaoh knew Joseph. I mean, had to have known him. He was acquainted with him, but he didn't respect and appreciate and regard Joseph as the previous Pharaoh had. Same thing here. The same thing here. What we're talking about here in verse 10 is an example and a case of apostasy. A generation arose that apostatized from the Lord. They knew who he was. They'd been raised to respect him. But they didn't. That's what I want to talk about this morning, is the possibility that there will arise in your family, in this church, at some point, a generation that does not know the Lord. They've been raised to believe and to respect God, but for reasons that we'll explore in just a moment, they don't any longer. Now, before we get more specific, let me look at some things about apostasy. And hear me out on this. It's possible for apostates to assemble in a local church like this. It's possible for apostates to participate. Men lead singing, make talks, preach, all sorts of things. Women too. Participate in those areas where they can. But while they are participating, they're apostates. Apostasy is not something that is just outward. Apostasy is something that takes place up here. My thinking may have changed. I don't love the Lord anymore, but for whatever reason, I'm still participating. But in my heart, he's gone. I don't regard him anymore. It's sort of like looking at a person physically. A few years ago, I had a good friend. He was a police officer in Corpus Christi. And if you walked in that door back there, you'd know he was a cop. I mean, he was a stereotypical cop. Physically, outwardly. Had a heart attack one New Year's Eve, nearly killed him. And my first reaction was, he couldn't have had a heart attack. He's too healthy. And I thought, healthy people don't have heart attacks. You know, if he's healthy, he wouldn't have a heart attack. Now, the same thing is true about somebody that all of a sudden they quit attending. You think, oh, they were so spiritual. No. If they were all that spiritual, they wouldn't have quit attending. I want us to understand that apostasy, just like physical illness, can be hidden within the heart, and apostates can have a condition hidden in their spiritual heart that manifests itself later on outwardly, but it's reflective of a condition that had been going on in their heart for a long, long time. And apostasy is not something that happens overnight. A person doesn't just wake up, or they go to bed one night and they are true to the Lord, and they wake up the next morning and all of a sudden it's gone. No, apostasy takes time, just like with the heart trouble thing. Many times heart trouble is something that is, it grows over time and it finally manifests itself, a stroke, heart attack, or something like that. And the same thing with apostates. And then here's where I want to focus attention this morning. Sometimes people have help, and that's a bad way to put it, but sometimes there are contributing factors, let's put it that way. Sometimes there are contributing factors to apostasy. Sometimes people apostatize, and there are things that had taken place in their life that accumulated over time and finally led them to just turn their back on the Lord and become a part of that other generation that didn't know the Lord. Now, I want to talk to you this morning about a case like that. It's been 35, 40 years ago, I guess. A guy's still a good friend of mine. He and I had a conversation. He was raised in Indiana. I was raised down in Port Arthur. But we were raised identically. Both of our parents, both sets of parents were Christians. We were taken to church from the time we were infants. He wouldn't marry his wife until he had converted her. That wasn't my case, but everything else was just alike. But not long after he converted his wife, he became an atheist. And one day, he and I were sitting at his house just visiting about a lot of things, and all of a sudden, we got into this discussion about, John, how did you get to where you are now? And he opened up, and he began to talk. Now, in all of this, he said, I'm not blaming anybody but myself for where I'm at. He said, I made some choices. But he said, there were some things that I saw growing up. There were some things that happened growing up that didn't help at all in where I'm at today. One of the first things he said was, David, he said, I was not raised in an environment, family or church environment, where it was encouraged to ask questions and to challenge. And to ask one of the most important questions in the world. It's a three-letter word. You might guess what it is? Why do we do this? Why do we not do that? Why do we believe this? Why? 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 And the answer came back, I can't believe you would ask such a question. I can't believe you would question what we're doing and what we believe. Acts chapter 17 and verse 11. I'm familiar with this verse. You probably used it in Bible discussions with your friends. Now, these were more noble-minded than those in Thessalonica, talking about the people in Berea. For they received the word with great eagerness, examining the scriptures daily to see whether these things were so. Now, we've used this verse, and I think accurately, to tell our religious friends, question, 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 question. Question your pastor. Question your priest. Question your parents. Question everybody. Why do we practice this? Why do we not do that? All of this. We tell those people out there to do it. That's good advice, and I agree with it. But is that good advice also for a 15-year-old? Growing up in our home, growing up in a church? Can't they ask those same questions? Shouldn't they also be able to ask a parent or a grandparent or an elder or a preacher, why did you preach that? And I'm saying respectfully so. Why do we not do so and so? Why do you teach this? Why are we different from... Now, if we encourage other people to ask such questions, why shouldn't we encourage our young people? Owen?
Or an 84-year-old.
Oh, doesn't apply. We already got it figured out, Owen.
No.
I'm kidding. I'm kidding. No, you're exactly right. I'm just sort of focusing upon preventing another generation coming along. But Owen's exactly right. Our life needs to be one of questioning. Turn to John 20. Now, here's a passage I think we've misused a lot of times. But Thomas, one of the 12, called Didymus, was not with them when Jesus came. This was after the resurrection. So the other disciples were saying to him, "We have seen the Lord." But he said to them, "Unless I see his hands and the imprint of the nails and put my finger into the place of the nails and put my hand into his side, I will not believe." Doubting Thomas. And we have just used that phrase, doubting Thomas, in a very, very negative, the very idea. Thomas doubting. That's great. We need to look at Thomas again. Thomas had good doubt. He doubted, but he left his doubt open for resolution. He said, "I doubt," but he was implying, "Give me the evidence and I'll believe." And that's what happened. We need more young people and older people. We need more younger people in this oncoming generation that are welcomed into an environment where they are encouraged to say, "I doubt. I doubt some things. I'm just not sure about some things." When I was working on this material, when I was putting our conversation together, I ran across something. I want to read this to you. It was written by a man named Paul Little. Now, I don't know what Paul Little's religious affiliation was, but he wrote a little book years ago called Know Why You Believe. What a great little book. And I was reading through that thing one day, and I came across this quote. I want to read it to you. I came across this quote, and I thought it was absolutely tremendous. Okay. When young people begin to think and seem to have doubts, they should be welcomed into a climate where they are free to unload and express their doubts. Many such young people have been driven underground and lost for good to the cause of Christ, Because the adults with whom they first talked had a high shock index. I love that phrase. The adults with whom they first talked had a high shock index. I can't believe you would doubt that. I can't believe that you don't believe that. That's terrible. What are we going to do? And you know, I'll get back to finish this quotation in a minute, but you know why a lot of elders and preachers and parents and grandparents react that way? You know why they act that way? Thank you. Exactly. They don't know the answer. They've been a Christian for 50 years. They don't have a clue. They don't know. And so they resort to this high shock index thing. Okay. They implied, these adults that had the high shock index, they implied that a good Christian would never doubt, and that the questioner's spiritual life must be slipping because he was thinking. What a tragic thing to think. Oh, my goodness. Young people aren't stupid. When they meet this response, they quickly shift gears and mouth the party line, even though it doesn't come from the heart. They quietly wait until they are out from under pressure to conform. And then they shed a faith that had never become their very own. That's the other generation. This was my friend John. Can you think of anybody that this quotation applies to? I grew up with a bunch of them. Whether we realize it or not, whenever we have this reaction to young people and we don't answer, we don't deal with their questions, they're going to get answered. In my friend John's case, he went to UT, which he gone to A&M, that wouldn't have happened. But that's another story. But he went to UT, and he had some lingering doubts about the existence of God and evolution creation. He could not get answers. Or he should have gotten answers. He got this high shock index reaction. But he got up to a university and found some atheists that were willing to sit down with him and say, okay, let me explain why evolution is valid and there is no God. And he accepted it. That might have been prevented had the people that he first talked with been willing to deal with his doubts. The second thing that John indicated to me was a factor in his becoming an apostate. He said, David, a lot of times I felt pushed into becoming a member of the church. I wasn't led, I was pushed into it. I'm working on some material now. I'm going to preach at home here in the next couple of weeks on the so-called age of accountability. Anybody know what that age is? It's 12, isn't it? Isn't that it? It's 13, I'm sorry. There is no chronological age. And yet we act that way. We ignore a kid until they hit 12, 13, and all of a sudden we just bang, 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 bang. Got to get baptized, got to get baptized. What's the matter with you? Got to get baptized. And they get baptized, and then we walk off and we dry them off and let them go. And we push them into so-called obedience. Got to get baptized and all of this stuff. And I'm not, obviously, I'm not downplaying the essentiality of baptism. That's not my point here. But rather that instead of leading people to have a devoted attitude and spirit toward the Lord, a lot of times we leave the impression that we're trying to get them to become a member of the same church we're a member of. Get your name on the roll. If you're a young man, start waiting on the table. And we just think everything's just great. You can't push people into Christ. Galatians 4 and verse 19. Now, Paul is writing in this context about Jews that were going back to the old law. And he said, "My little children, with whom I am again in labor until Christ is formed in you." What we want to do a lot of times, I'm not trying to paint with a broad brush here, but a lot of times what we want to do is get people in the church. And that's one of my pet peeves. We want to get people into the church, into the right religious organization. You'll read about that in the New Testament. What you read about is people having a relationship with Jesus. This idea of the Church of Christ being some sort of a religious movement, religious institution that you join like the Kiwanis Club. Not in the New Testament, I'm sorry. Having a relationship with Jesus is, and that's what Paul is talking about in Galatians 4:19. What we want to do is get a child to the point that they fall in love with Jesus and they want a relationship with Jesus. Now, this church thing will take care of itself. If we get people, I've got a 14-year-old granddaughter, 14 and a half. I'm really concerned about her. But I have taken the approach that I cannot push her into obedience. If I push her, I could do it because we have the kind of relationship, she respects me, and I could probably get her in a baptistry and immerse her. I could probably do that. But that's not what I want. What I want is for her to be devoted to Jesus, not granddad. I want her to love the Lord, not her grandfather. And the day that she is baptized, and I'm convinced that she's doing it because she loves the Lord, not because she loves granddad, then I've done something. So, instead of pushing our young people into obedience, let's lead them to Jesus and get them to live lives devoted to Christ. And we are less likely then to have them grow up and be a part of this other generation. 1 Peter 3 verse 15, along this same line. Sanctify Christ as Lord in your hearts. Sanctify Christ as Lord in your hearts. Who's going to be the person who directs my life? Not my parents, not my grandparents, not my spouse. It's going to be the Lord. Luke 17, verse 20. Jesus says, "The kingdom of God is within you." The kingdom of God is the rule of God in a person's life. We want to lead people to the place where we don't rule in their life, but the Lord rules in their life. And you don't push people into that. You lead people. And the pushing is easy. Pushing people is easy to do. Push, 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 push. And eventually you'll get, if you push cows, you'll push them. Yeah, they'll go in the pen. Well, you don't do people that way. You lead people. Something else that was a concern of my friend, and we'll talk about this more in our study this morning, and that was self-righteousness on the part of so many people he came into contact with that said they were Christians. Luke 18 and verse 9. Jesus told this parable to some people who trusted in themselves that they were righteous and viewed others with contempt. Ever caught yourself, maybe not intentionally, but caught yourself acting this way? Those people over there, they just tell you what, they may be nice people, but they're not like us. We just put our nose in the air and walk off. We've got the truth, and those poor folks over there don't, so we just, it's just sad. Really? This is exactly the attitude Jesus was speaking against in Luke 18, verse 9. It's easy for us, and I'm kind of overlapping into the sermon this morning, but it's easy for us to set standards of what is right arbitrarily and subjectively and judge people by our standards rather than by God. That's all I'll say about that, and we'll say more about it. But let's not be self-righteous. Let's not get to the place where everybody's going to hell but the people inside this room. Okay? Dangerous. Another thing that was a concern to my friend, and here's one that we've just blown off, these people talking this way, they just... He said, David, there were so many people in the local church. I saw where they were on Sunday. And I saw and I heard what they did on Sunday. But then he said, I saw what they did on Monday and Tuesday and Thursday and Friday. And it was altogether different. This whole thing about hypocrites in the church. Now, can people use that as an excuse? Yeah. But is there some validity to this problem of hypocrites in the church? Well, Romans chapter 2, verse 17. But if you bear the name Jew and rely upon the law and boast in God and know his will and approve the things that are essential, being instructed out of the law, and are confident that you yourselves are a guide to the blind, a light to those who are in darkness, a corrector of the foolish, a teacher of the immature, having in the law the embodiment of knowledge and of the truth, you therefore who teach another, do you not teach yourself? You who preach that one shall not steal, do you steal? You who say that one should not commit adultery, do you commit adultery? You who abhor idols, do you rob temples? You who boast in the law, do you through your breaking the law, do you dishonor God? For the name of God is blasphemed among the Gentiles because of you, just as it is written. Is it valid for friends like, or people like my friend John to say, you got hypocrites over there? Yeah, it is. And those hypocrites over there need to get their act together. I don't care if you've been immersed. I don't care who immersed you. I don't care how many assemblies you wouldn't think of missing. If you're a hypocrite in your daily life, people are hearing it and people are seeing it, and sometimes those people are 12, 13 years old. And it sticks in their mind, just as some things I saw and heard when I was that age stuck in my mind. And if we're going to try to bring our young people, our children and our grandchildren to the Lord, if they come to the assemblies on Sunday and dad's up there leading singing, mom's back there teaching a Bible class, all of this sort of thing, but the kid knows when we get home, it's not anywhere near that. Dad may get up and teach it and preach it. Grandma may get in the back of the Bible class and teach it. But I know what I know. I know what I see. I know what I hear. And there's a big discrepancy between what's at home and what's at church. And if that's the case, I can almost guarantee you that young person will become a part of that other generation that does not know the Lord that we began our study looking at. There has to be consistency between what we profess here and what we do at home. Let me give you, what time do we quit, by the way? What's it? Or are you going to tell me now to shut up? I can do that. What time?
10 after.
Oh, 10 after. Oh, okay. I've got about 20 more minutes worth of material, but we'll... Let me illustrate this point with you about conduct that is consistent between church and home and workplace. A few years ago, when I lived in McAllen, Texas, there was a guy down there named Charles Garner, one of the finest men I ever knew in my life. And he died back in the early 1990s and went back for his memorial service. And I've never seen a service like it in my life. Everybody spoke, men, women, Christians, non-Christians, everybody spoke at Charles's service. But the one person, that thing went on for about an hour, the one person who I was most impressed by was a woman who was a co-worker of Charles's. She worked with him Monday through Friday, 80 hours a week. They worked really, really long hours. And here's what she said. If Jesus Christ ever comes back to this earth and lives like a man, he will come back as Charles Garner. Whoa. And I thought, I wonder if my wife, before she died, I thought, I wonder if my wife could say that about me. Husbands, is that the evaluation that your wife and your children put upon you? Grandparents? Those grandkids look at you and they know church conduct and they know home conduct. And they know about Jesus. And their evaluation of you is, that's the way Jesus would talk. That's the way Jesus would act. My dad, my mom, my grandparents are just like Jesus. If I understand correctly, the definition of a Christian is a what? Follower of Christ. This little thing, WWJD, that was so popular years ago, there's something to that. What would Jesus do? Okay. That dictates how I should act. Okay, I've got a lot more to that conversation and a lot more I wanted to say. But this is enough to get me in trouble. I don't know. But seriously, do you have any questions or comments that you have about the thing? Because I presented this material before and it was misunderstood. And I was criticized for it. Well, that's fine. I don't mind the criticism. And you don't have to criticize publicly if you want to. That's fine. Got any questions or comments that you want to make about any of this?
I appreciate what you said. I appreciate the entire blessing.
Thank you. Appreciate it. All right. That's it. Thank you.